This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Susan Benesch is the founder of the Dangerous Speech Project. She coined the term to describe fear-inducing divisive rhetoric that often precedes mass violence. Benesch will give the annual Winnie Veenstra Peace Lecture at Western Michigan University. It's called Social Media and Mass Violence, Monday night at 6 o'clock in the Bernhard Center. Susan Benesch, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Gordon.
Can you begin by telling us how would dangerous speech be different from hate speech?
So hate speech is a very widely used and common term, but the funny thing about it is there's no really clear definition for it. Different people understand it in very different ways. For example, if I asked you, is it hate speech to draw the Prophet Muhammad? Well, there are many people in the world who would find that extremely offensive and provocative, and they would say, yes, of course it's hate speech. And there are lots of other people who might not even know that that's an offensive thing to do and would say, of course, it isn't hate speech. And there are many, many other examples. Dangerous speech, by contrast, is a narrower, more specific category of human expression. It is any kind of communication that makes people more likely to condone or even to participate in violence against another group of people, any kind of a group of people. And from studying an awful lot of this kind of communication, we have realized that, in fact, it has much more to do with an emotion that is not hatred, and that emotion is fear. It's much more effective to make people fear another group of people or see them as a serious threat in order to turn them violently against that group of people than to try to make them hate. So there's quite a lot of hate speech that isn't dangerous. For example, I feel very confident that I could say any number of terrible things to you, Gordon, and you still wouldn't be willing to condone mass violence. That has to do with the fact that the dangerousness of speech depends on who's speaking, who's listening or reading, and what the context is in other respects.
So who are the most effective communicators of dangerous speech? And by effective, I guess I would mean the people who are likely to draw a violent response of some sort or inspire a violent response.
That's a wonderful question. And it depends on which audience you're talking about. Some of us, like me, I always tell my students, are not very effective dangerous speakers to any audience. Even I can't even influence my students enough to be a successful dangerous speaker. But there are, of course, some audiences that are especially susceptible to dangerous speech. Maybe they're already fearful for one reason or another. And depending on the audience, the most influential, the most effective dangerous speaker might be a political figure. But very often, it's not a political figure. It could be a celebrity, for example, or a celebrity from the stage or from film or performer of music. There was a very important figure active in the Rwanda genocide who was a pop star, one of the most popular pop stars in Rwanda, who was an influential dangerous speaker. In other cases, might be a religious figure or even someone who just has a lot of status in a particular community. It's anybody other people have a reason to pay close attention to.
So you mentioned that it depends on the audience. And I suppose all of us, if we really stop and think about it, have buttons that can be pressed. But are there characteristics that we could find that say that this type of person is more susceptible to dangerous speech, someone who is more likely to be led down the path to doing something violent in response to the message?
Yeah, that's another great question. And it's worth asking it regarding individuals and also regarding groups. So groups of people may be more susceptible to these kinds of messages if they are already feeling anxiety or feeling fear. Maybe they are not confident about their livelihood. They've lost their jobs. They're feeling worried already that there's another group that is enjoying advantages that they don't have. All of those kinds of feelings and resentments can be played upon by a dangerous speaker. we have also observed in some cases that if a group of people, for one reason or another, has a strong sense of duty to obey authority figures, that might be, for example, in the country of Myanmar, the majority religion is Buddhism. Buddhists there are taught that they must obey monks, who are, of course, very influential figures, but there is also a very specific religious and cultural norm that one must pay a duty of respect and obedience to a monk. And so if you hear a message from a monk, you will be even more likely to believe it and to obey it. And there are a number of other situations in which, for cultural reasons, people defer particularly or obey particularly a particular figure or a message. Now, regarding individuals, we are just at the moment once again experiencing, you know, terrible shock and distress over another mass murder, another massacre that took place in Christchurch in New Zealand. The person who committed that massacre published a long manifesto that describes him as a person who shared some characteristics with one of his heroes, Anders Breivik. Anders Breivik is another mass murderer who killed more than 70 people in Norway. These are people who feel a particularly strong sense of grievance, and they feel threatened by other people or groups of people. They are usually loners and so forth. So we can describe those individuals as particularly vulnerable to such messages because of their psychological and social characteristics. One can also think about those individuals, they're sometimes popularly called lone wolves, as not only individuals, but as the most vulnerable members of a group of people. So for every person who's willing to go and commit a massacre, unfortunately, there are many others who are reading similar content, often online, and are convinced and inspired by it. But for various reasons, don't actually go and start murdering people. So the one who does go and commit a mass murder, we can think of as the leading edge, you know, or the most likely to respond among a group of people.
And the title of your address is called Social Media and Mass Violence. So many people, as you're saying there, would read the same messages, but would not respond in the same way. At the same time, you know, what's the responsibility of the owner of a social media platform when it comes to the dissemination of dangerous speech?
That's a complicated question, Gordon. I guess the first way to answer it is by looking at the law. You know, what's the legal responsibility? And in the United States, we have a law that was originally part of called the Communications Decency Act. Most of that act was actually struck down as unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. But part of it that remains in our law is called Section 230. And it says pretty clearly that internet companies, like internet service providers, do not have any form of legal liability for content that people post on their platforms. And for many, many years, the companies would say, listen, we are not supplying the content. You know, we're like a utility that is providing the pipes, and it's all the users who are filling them with water. And we can't control what sort of water people put into the pipes. That's not up to us. It's not our job, and it's not our responsibility. Although that law is still our law in the United States, the companies have begun to adopt a different attitude and to try to take down bad content more and more for a number of reasons. One is there's increasingly strong outcry against it. And another is that many countries, unlike the United States, do not agree that those companies aren't responsible. And then a third reason is that that law was written before social media became anywhere near as big as it is. So one can argue that social media companies like Facebook and Twitter do have more responsibility for content, even if they're not actually producing it, since with their algorithms, they exercise quite a lot of control over what we actually see online. And so increasingly, even if the companies are not legally responsible in the United States for dangerous speech and other harmful content on their platforms, they are beginning to accept some kind of social or moral responsibility and to try to take some steps against it. The trouble is that the scale is so gigantic that it's quite a difficult problem to solve.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. I'm speaking with Susan Benesch, the founder of the Dangerous Speech Project. She will deliver the annual Winnie Veenstra Peace Lecture at Western Michigan University Monday night at 6 o'clock in the Bernhard Center. You've worn a lot of different hats in your life, including journalist. And, of course, one of the things we run up against here is the question of freedom of speech. Is freedom of speech something that makes it easier for someone to perpetrate dangerous speech? Because we do have this idea that people can share opinions even if they're not popular.
It is true that under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, it is not only not illegal to share unpopular and unpleasant opinions, it's my constitutional right, and it's yours, and it's the right of everyone else in the United States. Our law does not protect all incitement to violence, however. Under a famous case called Brandenburg v. Ohio, you cannot incite people to violence if there is a probability of what is called imminent lawless action. Now, that's a very narrow category of dangerous speech that is prohibited in the United States. So you're absolutely right that there's plenty of dangerous speech that is legal here. However, that doesn't worry me so much, since although I am also a lawyer, I don't think that criminal law or criminal prosecution are very effective tools against this kind of communication. And here are a few reasons why. One is criminal prosecution takes a long time, generally, whereas the effect of this kind of communication can be very powerful and it can influence people quickly. And while somebody is being prosecuted, in some cases, the prosecution only makes that terrible speech spread more, not less. So, for example, there's a far-right-wing and extremely anti-Muslim politician in the Netherlands called Geert Wilders. And he's been prosecuted more than once for extremely offensive and fear-mongering remarks he's made about Muslims, for example. And during the last trial, in which he was eventually convicted, he became more popular in the Netherlands, and his party was actually contesting elections at the time. And although he was convicted, the party did better in those elections than it had previously. So that's one of only many examples in which it seems that criminally prosecuting someone for speech can sometimes only help their cause in the sense that it makes them better known. It makes them and their dangerous speech better known, and sometimes also makes people sympathize with them because they may feel that the person is being unfairly prosecuted. So trying to suppress or censor such content is, of course, the first solution that comes to mind, and it may seem like the best one, but it is very often counterproductive. So that's one reason why I'm very strongly defensive of freedom of speech. But there are two other tremendously important ones. And one is that it's a fundamental right that we must, in all circumstances, be very careful not to trample on people's right to express themselves, since it is such a critical element of self-realization and also of the functioning of a democracy. But then another reason is that people who are afraid of feeling grievances need a peaceful way of expressing their grievances and trying to get them resolved. Otherwise, they're more likely to resort to violence. So protecting freedom of expression is, in fact, one way of preventing violence. We must be careful not to forget that.
So if criminal prosecutions are not the way to go, or if we're not, and if we're not interested in suppressing free speech, and presumably we all agree that that's a value that Americans hold, what are some things that might counteract dangerous speech, or what might prevent dangerous speech from actually leading to violence?
Thank you for that terrific question. That is something that I and my colleagues have spent a lot of time studying now. And, you know, we have noticed that although formal law, criminal law, is not very effective at suppressing or countering dangerous speech from what we can see, there are informal rules that can be extremely powerful and effective. Just give you an example. You know, as I said before, in the United States, we have a constitutionally protected right to say terrible things to one another and also to post them online, including, for example, terribly racist remarks. However, I sometimes ask my students, you know, what is the likelihood that an American political candidate will use the N-word in public, knowing that the microphone is on? Remember that that is not illegal at all. On the contrary, it is that person's constitutionally protected right to use that word and to say terrible racist things. But my students usually say the likelihood is zero or almost zero. Why? That's because there is not a very strong informal, what we would call norm or rule, against saying such a thing. Every single political candidate in the United States knows that and understands that if they said that, they would almost certainly lose the election. So that's a very strong incentive that has nothing to do with formal law, but that operates quite effectively to control what people say. The catch is that those informal norms work quite well. For example, in my classroom, there are all sorts of things that my students will not say, even though there's no law against it. They just understand that there's a very strong social rule against it. But online, we have not yet figured out very well how to establish and reinforce norms like that. Still, it happens that many people express their opinions against racist or xenophobic or misogynist or other forms of hateful or dangerous speech. And sometimes there's no question that that's having a favorable effect. I can give you an example. On the very same day, last Friday, the very same day that the Christchurch massacre was committed, a senator in Australia posted a statement in which he essentially said that the reason why this massacre had happened was that there was too much Muslim immigration. And he said a number of other tremendously offensive things. There was a gigantic reaction against this man and his statement. And by the way, it wasn't the first such statement he has made. Last August, he called for a final solution, that's the term that he used, which is, of course, very familiar from the Holocaust. He called for a final solution to the problem of Muslim immigration. And then he refused to apologize for that statement. So it was unfortunately not surprising when he made this terribly offensive statement on the very same day as the Christchurch massacre. The following day, a teenager walked up to him while he was speaking and broke an egg on the head of this politician, and the response online was gigantic against the politician and in favor of the teenager, since people were so disgusted by what the politician had said. To put it a different way, the counter speech against this politician was a torrent, quite gigantic and almost certainly much more influential than he could possibly be, at least on the majority of people. What still worries me is that people like that Australian senator may, although they are so widely denounced by lots of people, may still be influential over those alienated people like the man who committed the massacre. So those are really two different questions. You know, how do we influence the majority of people to avoid such language? And how do we also prevent the small number of people who are willing to commit massacres from becoming radicalized and doing so? Over the last 2 years, my colleagues and I have been studying online responses to dangerous and hateful speech from around the world. And although, of course, it is discouraging to see how much hateful and dangerous speech there is online, we also have been, frankly, quite encouraged to discover a large variety of vigorous and ingenious responses to it. People are trying all kinds of interesting things. Just to give you a couple of examples, in some cases, people do exactly the opposite of trying to suppress or censor hateful content. For example, in Brazil, there was a project called Mirrors of Racism, in which an advertising firm working together with a small human rights group found extreme offensive racist comments online and deliberately amplified them, blew them up into huge letters and posted them on billboards in the neighborhoods where the people who had posted this content lived, with a tagline that said, virtual racism, comma, real consequences. The people who made this campaign deliberately obscured the profile photographs of the people who had posted this racist content, since they didn't want to subject them to what we call dog piles, that is to say, huge numbers of people who would have attacked them online to denounce their behavior. Instead, what they were trying to do is shame these people, but even more importantly, to point out to other Brazilians that this kind of content proliferates online and that it's not acceptable. So they recorded some very interesting interviews with people walking past the billboards, and they asked them, what do you think about this? And the people said, listen, we try to tell ourselves that our society is not racist, but this does oblige us to confront reality and see that we have a lot more work to do and to take on some of that responsibility ourselves. That can be an enormously valuable thing to do. It's an unusual kind of response to hateful or dangerous speech, but it seems to be, in some cases, tremendously important and useful to call it out. And then the final example I'd want to mention to you is the response of the Prime Minister of New Zealand in the immediate aftermath of the massacre in Christchurch has been to say that the victims, the people who were killed in that massacre, she said, they are us, and the person who committed it is not. She put on a scarf and went to personally comfort some of the mourners. In other words, she's gone really out of her way to express solidarity with Muslims in New Zealand, to celebrate the diversity of the country in very clear and explicit terms, and to unequivocally, of course, denounce people who would like to drive Muslims away. There's no question that she has had a powerful impact in doing so, and we need more influential leaders to follow that example.
Susan Benesch is the founder of the Dangerous Speech Project. Thank you very much for your time.
More than welcome.
Benesch will discuss social media and mass violence when she gives the annual Winnie Vinstra Peace Lecture at Western Michigan University Monday night at 6 o'clock in the Bernhard Center. Links with more information can be found at WMUK.org. You can subscribe to WMUK's West Southwest podcast through Apple iTunes and by searching podcasts in Google Music. It's also available on our website and the WMUK app. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.